When Ferguson, Missouri police officer Darren Wilson shot and killed Michael Brown, created an aftermath of racial outcries, protests, political grandstanding, and mixed stories via the media. This past week, the Justice Department released two reports on that incident. One report declared that there was insufficient evidence to go after Darren Wilson for any civil rights violations or crimes. Separate reports said that there were problems with how the police in Ferguson operated and listed a variety of steps seen as ways to repair that situation. My next guest joins us to share his analysis of all this. He's a former assistant director of the FBI, current president of the Law Enforcement Legal Defense Fund, Ronald Hosko. Good morning, Ronald.
Good morning, Chris.
And I'll give you Ronald's website, policedefense.org. That's the website for Law Enforcement Legal Defense Fund. And as I said, Ronald, the Justice Department said 35,000 records regarding the operation of the Ferguson Police Department, as well as the incident regarding Michael Brown and Officer Wilson, and they came to those two separate conclusions. First of all, with the shooting of Michael Brown, I think, speaking completely as a layperson, other laypeople say the same thing. The belief is an officer is always supposed to protect their weapon, even if someone wants to be a total idiot and go for that. And, I mean, it could be dismissed by saying, well, then someone like an idiot gets what an idiot deserves. But is there some justification to say that police officers need better training to prevent a situation escalating to that point?
Police officers across the country really need to be well-schooled in trying to de-escalate whatever situation they may encounter. However, there are going to be situations, and perhaps this was one, between Wilson and Michael Brown, where regardless of what the police officer was trying to do, the offender is going to take offensive action, that they're going to do something that's dangerous, criminal, unpredictable, and that's going to cause great risk and potentially great harm in the community or to the police officers. You guys up in New Jersey, I'm sure we're watching very closely events over the fall where a Pennsylvania State Trooper was gunned down and another one seriously shot. And that's not a situation where you're going to have an opportunity to de-escalate. Yesterday, a police officer gunned down in North Philadelphia during a store robbery. Again, what's his opportunity to de-escalate against, you know, two hardened criminals who are going to come in bent on robbery
and, of course,
will you know, take out any cop that gets in their way? And they did.
And the two NYPD officers who were assassinated by simply sitting in their cars.
That's right. So, yes, de-escalation is a tactic and a technique that all officers need to know and have in their bag of tricks. But it's not going to work in every occasion, particularly not where you have a person who is bent on committing a crime.
Is this a consequence, and others that we've seen throughout the recent months, a consequence of police being technically de-armed? You can't use the chokehold. Some won't allow mace, pepper sprays, things along that line. Have too many tools been taken away from the police?
I don't think so. In fact, I think over recent years there has been a concerted effort across law enforcement and, you know, with the private industry who stands to make some money in selling their new technologies to law enforcement to put less lethal technologies in the hands of police. And where those technologies can be employed, it can prevent people from losing their lives. If you give me a conductive energy weapon, a taser, and I can deploy that successfully. I know how to use it. I'm trained in it. I don't use it excessively on someone who doesn't need that level of force, that I can avoid taking somebody's life. But there are limitations to every one of those tools. Taser is a good example where I need to, if I'm shooting you from some sort of distance, on a day like today, where we're all bundled up with a couple of layers against the cold, it could be that the barbs of that device are not going to penetrate. And so a threat may be charging me, may be enraged, may be doing something that's even more deadly, and the tool that I've been given isn't going to work. And police officers have to make these decisions frequently in a split second. You know, this is the case with Darren Wilson. Here we have an officer sitting in his car who tells two guys to get out of the middle of the street because they're obstructing traffic, and then recognizes them as probably having committed this store robbery, backs up, tries to get out of his car, and all of a sudden he's being assaulted in his car. If you read the report basically says that. Here's a bigger man who's in the window of a police car wrestling with an officer for his gun. And as the report indicates, Wilson couldn't get to a less lethal weapon. He couldn't. If he got to his mace, he was going to, in effect, mace himself as well and potentially incapacitate himself. He could get to, his ass was behind him, so he can't physically access it. And if he did, he wouldn't have room to swing it or do much with it anyway. And now he's in a struggle with a larger subject to retain his own weapon. That's a dangerous situation. And I think that the lies, the hands up, don't shoot lies that followed, really mask a bigger issue here. And that is Michael Brown was a criminal. He had just done a strong-arm robbery in a store, had menaced the store owner or the shopkeeper on his way out, used similar language with Wilson when that encounter started, and all of this is in the report. There is not a single credible witness who gave evidence against Darren Wilson. A single credible witness.
And there were many people who changed their stories as time progressed, including associates and friends of Michael Brown. We're talking to Ronald Hosko, former assistant director of the FBI, current president of the Law Enforcement Legal Defense Fund, policedefense.org on the web. And you were listening to Issues and Ideas. Let's flip to the flip side, the second report by the Justice Department, which, again, they said that they studied 35,000 separate documents to get a look for trends, actions, and the ways that the Ferguson, Missouri police operated. And just in a very brief summary, basically, the municipal leaders instructed the Ferguson police to look at the residents as revenue sources and try to find any possible means to ticket, to fine, to imprison, and fine. And this is something that recently NPR did a report on, too. It's not just indicative of Ferguson, Missouri, just because of the municipal economies these days and the state being less of a resource for municipalities for funds. This is what many smaller towns especially are turning to try to keep their financial boat alive. Any justification in that report saying that that's a wrong action to be taking?
Right. So your comments really indicate the pressure points on this issue. One is the need of municipalities to raise money, that whether that's tax money, certainly almost all are raising some revenue because of fines for relatively minor offenses. So that exists everywhere. And then the balance that needs to be struck to determine is the rate at which we issue fines and the purpose for which we issue fines appropriate? Are we trying to ensure public safety, red light cameras, speeding? All of those things are important, and the fines that come with them or the points on your license that come with them hopefully have a strong deterrent effect so that it's not somebody speeding down your street and running over, children playing in the road. And so there's an important purpose behind some of these things. But it looked like, based on the report, that the issuance of these fines became really a driver for city government. And if true, if we find out over time after Ferguson officials and DOJ go back and forth about this report, if we find out that is substantively true, it's concerning not only for the police but for the municipal government there, who appeared to be really behind driving the police for numbers, higher numbers, more fines, and to run a government and their court system to adjudicate these fines, appeared to be nothing more than a mill, that they would have hundreds of people standing waiting to adjudicate their fines. Very concerning.
And just because of the demographic of the community, the majority being black and the majority of those being on the less than successful economically, it's causing an inordinate amount of incarcerations and difficulties in paying what are, in many cases, excessive fines for not just, for violations that aren't creating dangers. License plate lied out, or I heard one story where someone was getting fined for having their grass uncut.
Right. Right. And listen, similar things happen in other places. You should travel with appropriate safety equipment. I know in my own community, you can get a fine. You can get an assessment for not tending to your yard. You know, your grass gets so high, it brings down other, you know, neighboring values. So there are important reasons behind this, but not to turn city government into a mill, into a processing plant for no good purpose. And I think, you know, where we have to be a little bit skeptical of the DOJ report is the statistical piece. And certainly the anecdotes in that report are very concerning. The general treatment of citizens by people in the police force and by this the court system there. But you have to be a little bit cautious when you're looking at statistics, because statistics, as we know, can be manipulated.
Absolutely.
To present the picture you want to present. And it could be that here you have a black population that was roughly 67% of the city. And they were getting somewhere in the 70s or higher among the fines. Well, it could be they were offending at a higher rate. It could be that they were engaged in offenses that, at a higher rate than white citizens there. Hence, the numbers are higher. That doesn't automatically mean it's biased policing. It could be higher offending. But put in the bigger context, it's very concerning with some of the comments, competitions for issuing fines. How many individual fines I could give you for one encounter? You know, 8, 10, 12 fines for different offenses. You know, that's very concerning, and it may tell the bigger story, which is a problem.
And the positive out of all this with these two reports is it's creating a reality of the incident, and the aftermath is actually maybe working to bring the community and law enforcement together where there had been a chasm and canyon between the two sides, and working together will resolve a lot of these aftermath issues through the reports and further studies and moving forward. Learn more about the Law Enforcement Legal Defense Fund, which Ronald is the current president of, policedefense.org. He's also a former assistant director of the FBI. Ronald Hosko, thanks so much for being here this morning.
Great talking to you.